Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Unlocking your sleep potential, brought to you by cleanmybed.com.
Right, so welcome to our second episode of our podcast on sleep science or sleep health, whatever you like to call it. It's all about getting a good night's sleep. And today, as usual, we have our regular guest, our co-host today, Dr. Jill Warner, who's been with us throughout the series. And she's going to be doing a podcast later on in the series, particularly around the allergy side. But she's co-hosting with me today. But we have Dr. Dale Ray, who is the director of the Sleep Science Center at Cape Town and a senior lecturer at the Division of Physiological Sciences at the University of Cape Town here in South Africa, and has been a guest on the Science of Sport podcast before, but literally lives in this world of sleep and sleep health and all those sort of things pretty much every single day. First of all, welcome to the podcast. Just tell us briefly what you do in terms of sleep science at where you are now. What is your job essentially?
Okay, great. Thanks, and thanks for having me, Mike. It's great to chat to you about sleep again. So I guess I have a dual purpose when it comes to sleep. On one hand, I have an academic role at the University of Cape Town where I teach around sleep, but I also do a lot of research. And that's obviously a huge passion. And I'm fortunate that the area that I'm researching is something that I'm extremely excited about. And then I also am the director of Sleep Science, which is a company outside of the University of Cape Town, which offers sleep-related services for individuals, sports teams, companies, etc. So I really do get to apply what we learn in the real world.
So who comes to you and why do they come to you?
So the individuals that come to us can be general man on the street who's struggling with sleep, with known or unknown sleep disorders. It can be athletes who are looking for that little bit of extra edge in terms of their performance. And it can be companies who are wanting to have a look at the sleep of their employees, because we know that that's got such a big impact on workplace productivity.
And that's an interesting one. So the average person comes to you, and what do they generally come to you with? Is it the fact that they can't sleep the whole night, or is it insomnia, or is it the fact they've got sleep apnea? Is there a percentage of people who come to you with certain conditions?
Yeah, it's a range of things. I suppose we often see people that are a bit at the end of their tether, and they have usually tried many different things, very often been to many different specialists and haven't really had any satisfactory progress. So for the most part, they do tend to be insomnia related issues. But very often in our sessions with them, as we unpack their sleep story and we learn about their history, we find other things that are at play. There might be obstructive sleep apnea, might be other things like restless leg or narcolepsy, and very often actually sleep-wake circadian type disorders. So it's a bit of a mix, but primarily insomnia.
So, I mean, I always wanted to ask somebody who does this sort of research, do you have a room where people go and sleep and you watch them with cameras for the whole night?
No.
I always thought that was the true thing about this.
Yeah, so there are different types or different ways in which we can study sleep. So for sleep research, we do do what's called polysomnography, and that is where the person will sleep hooked up to a number of different monitors, and a camera may be indicated depending what we're looking at. That can be in the laboratory, but we actually prefer to examine sleep in the home-based environment because we think that that's more natural. So very often then we'll use a portable kit which people can take home, and we can look at their brain activity, for example, while they're sleeping at home. But more commonly, we use little wrist-worn devices to look at people's habitual sleep-wake patterns over a number of days, because that gives us a lot more information about their usual sleep.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So let's talk specifically what we're going to be talking in this podcast about, and that's around athletic performance. And before we start chatting to you, we've got a very interesting interview that Jill did with Rake Nettling, who, of course, to South Africans, is very well known as our freestyle gold medalist at the Olympic Games, but, of course, was a world-class swimmer back in his day.
Well, Well, I am absolutely delighted to be speaking to Rek Nietling, South Africa's gold medal winning freestyle swimmer, and to discuss with him the importance of sleep in his athletic performance. Rek, thank you so much for talking to us. It's wonderful to have you here. Could I ask you, when you were swimming for your country at world-class level, did you think about sleep as an important part of your training program?
Hi, Joel, and it's really nice to be here. Absolutely. I think, recovery is such a big part and oftentimes, I think overlooked aspect of high performance, training. So sleep was extremely important. I think from when I was a young, just a young swimmer, my mom always, tell me to take a nap in between the heats and finals. And, pretty soon that became the, my routine, and it would signal if I had a good nap. It would usually, signal some form of record breaking performance, in the finals. So, back then, this was late 80s, early 90s. I don't think there was a lot of studies yet, but even just in practice, I instinctively knew that, sleeping was, was extremely important. And then, as I progressed in my career and in between my first and my last Olympics, I competed in 4 Olympic Games. More and more studies came out, and just how important when to sleep. Extremely important. I think the one risk, though, is that what would happen from a psychological point of view if you didn't manage to sleep. So, oftentimes, Olympic Village, you are staying with, 10,000 other athletes. Maybe there's some noisy ones. Luckily at the Olympic Games, the swimming is the first week, but maybe you're competing on day 8, and on day 5 and 6, your noisy neighbors, they finish competing and they keep you up all night. Are you going to be, from a psychological point of view, are you going to be resilient enough to still compete? Reason that you couldn't sleep, but extremely important. And I think it's something that there's still a lot studies to be done to understand exactly, the importance of it. And especially, I think, the timing of it and how much is enough. How long before I've overslept. Well, I've overslept, almost missed races from jet lag. I've slept too long, in the day, naps, and then like a little bit lethargic, where, sometimes just a little cat nap can do wonders for performance. So I think, it's extremely.
Can help you. I love the idea of trying to take a nap whilst you've got your fellow competitors celebrating what's happened to them. That must be really hard, right? How would you go about, if in that situation, when you're in an Olympic Village, for example, and that sort of thing is happening, what would you actually do about trying to be able to sleep or to catch your nap when other people around are not at the same point in their competition as you are?
Yes, I think that comes with experience. That you have to be aware, and that is what training is all about, right? Is to put yourself in situations to, when you get to the actual event, that you've trained to be able to do that. So that just means that when you go to competitions, that that you embrace adversity. Sometimes you put yourself under adversity. You ask your family to put your, to put you under adversity, and to teach yourself a few triggers in order to be able to sleep. I think what I used to do is to really visualize So I would have a routine depending on what race, what I struggled with. I would just, visualize, something positive in extreme detail. And halfway through it, I would fall asleep. earplugs just to keep the noise out. Try not to be in a place where there's lots of light. Extremely important. I've got a interesting story of just how important sleep and how determined we were. And my former teammate, his name is Lyndon Ferns. He was the second swimmer on that relay when we won gold. He almost got aggressive over his sleep. If he didn't sleep enough or somebody woke him up, he would get really angry. And we were in Omaha, Nebraska, and it was I think it was in August, July, and it was the tornado season. And I had never experienced a tornado before in my life. And we were in the hotel. And about 2 o'clock, we heard the sirens going off. And myself and Lyndon, we weren't sure what it was. We turned the air conditioner up so the fan would, make a bit more noise. We put our earplugs in and we went back to sleep. The next morning, we realized that we were the only two in the massive hotel that didn't go into the shelter for the tornado.
Love it, right?
So that, the two South African boys, we didn't pay too much attention to the sirens, but we had a job to do the next day in the pool, and we were just really determined to get to our sleep.
And I'm sure that was the day you won and everybody else had sat in the area away from everything all night.
there's some interesting stories. Your teammates, like I said, a guy like Lyndon was very passionate about his sleep and could only room with me, I guess, because I also enjoyed his sleep.
Brilliant.
But I think it's progressed quite a bit, from those days. Extremely important.
You're mentioning environmental factors, right? And obviously, people understand, oh, it must be light, you mustn't have looked at a screen too long, you mustn't be disturbed. Were there any other particular aspects of your life or the environment just before sleeping, before a big competition, that you would say were particularly important for you?
I think the other thing is that a nice cold room, for me was always important. I think just to be in a positive state of mind. Also obviously what you consume, what you eat, what you drink, is very important. One of the big challenges that you have when you get to a competition is that a lot of times in swimming, the final of your race might be 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. Your heart rate goes over 200, so it's this incredible spike of all the hormones and lactic acid and that you can imagine. Then you have to swim down. You have to get drug tested. You have to eat something. You often get back to the hotel 11:30, 12. You're excited. You broke a record. You won an Olympic gold medal, and then you have to try to fall asleep. Maybe you had a coffee or two, maybe a Red Bull, and then you have to get that caffeine out of your system and try to calm down in order to recover for the next day. So those kind of spikes and up and downs, is a challenge. I think it's quite, well documented about the Australian swimming team and their over-reliance on sleeping pills. And again, the next morning that creates a different, problem where you feel a bit lethargic and then you need something again to pick you up.
Absolutely. I mean, taking those pills, it's very, very hard the next morning to be totally on top of what you're doing. They create a fuzz, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Just thinking about international travel, Rick, do you feel that now there's more of a thought about the fact that jet lag can influence your performance because of sleep being very difficult at the wrong time of day or night?
Yes. Again, I really think it's a little bit easier now. I think there's people understand it, you know, a bit better. I think it's easier to travel these days. I think there's better connections. When I used to travel, you could go through Heathrow, maybe Frankfurt, Dubai, Qatar and Turkish Airlines, and you know the lounges and how the aircraft used to be. I'm really going to date myself here, but my first international trip, I went to Greece and there was a smoking flight. So people were still smoking on those aircraft. You can imagine what it would do to your performance. But
I can totally coincide with you on that one. I remember going to a conference on an Alitalia plane, and one side of the plane was smoking and the other side was not. Yeah. All the way down, so there was no avoiding it.
It's like the smoke is going to stay on the one side. So I think the athletes are traveling, I think, a little bit better, with that understanding. The rule was always, one day for each hour that you had to be in the location before just to be able to recover. I spent 12 years of my life in Tucson, Arizona, where I went to university and then I worked there. So that's a 9-hour time difference to South Africa. So I had lots of practice and almost had it down to a fine art form to be able to deal with, jet lag. And I think there are some great apps now where if you stick to it, then, jet lag really doesn't have to affect you. But just try to stay up for as long as possible, go for a walk, try to stay in the sun for as long as possible, and just don't take that nap. It doesn't matter how tired you are. Just try to stay awake as long as possible to be able to sleep through the night.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you there. It's not the easiest thing, but it is really interesting now how people are taking more notice of it, and there are help. There is help for people to do that. Rick, I'm going to have to ask you, now that I know that as well as the swimming, you're now becoming a polo player. Now, that's a very different scenario to when you're swimming by yourself. Now you're riding and you're part of a team with a horse at the same time. How do you think about that when you go to sleep the night before a tournament and you're playing?
I think it's pretty much the same as, with swimming. I think even more so with a horse and, with the team and with your grooms, you want to visualize, everything from when the horses, leave the stables, that everything goes well. So I think there's even more to visualize, and, that's what I do. And it helps me with my sleep. So
the horses are helping.
Yeah. I think I'm fortunate. Maybe I'm just lazy that I don't have new techniques, but the techniques that helped me to get to become an Olympic champion, I can really apply that to, and I do apply it to everything that I do, even in business as an amateur polo player, or enthusiast, just to visualize myself on the horse, to be able to take a nap before, a game, just to go through that routine in the different practices that I have, that you practice what you want to do in the game. So I just pretty much do what I've been doing for the last, 30 years, is just now on top of a horse.
Right, that's fantastic. It really has been lovely talking to you, and thank you so much for spending the time. I know people will be fascinated to hear about the techniques that you used in such a pressurized environment, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people following you now in your new area as far as the polo playing and other important sports that you're getting involved with. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Jill. Thank you.
So plenty of things to tackle with Rake, and let's first of all start with the fact that obviously sleep was very important to him. The first thing is, how important is sleep for recovery in athletic performance?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. And I mean, already in 2008, there was an article which was published which described sleep recovery as being the new frontier in high performance athletics. So, I mean, athletes are looking for marginal gains, as you know. And I think originally people thought that sleep was important for performance, and to a large extent it is. I mean, we can't deny that. But I think the real gem in terms of what sleep can do for athletes is that it promotes recovery. So when we sleep, there are a number of processes which happen biologically, which allow us to adapt to the training that we've been doing. Not to mention the importance of sort of making sure that your immune system is more than intact, so that you don't obviously get sick or become overtrained. So that's really critical. But from a recovery perspective, there's now some lovely evidence that's coming out to show that when you have good sleep following training, you really do become stronger and adapt more, which means that the next day you go out and train, you can train harder than the guy next to you who hasn't had the same amount of sleep.
Really interesting what you say, Dale, about the effect of sleep on your immune system, because I think people don't always consider that if you don't sleep well, you actually don't have a good immune response to the triggers around you in the environment. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, sure. So sleep and immunity are just inextricably linked, really. And if I were to extremely crudely define divide your immune system into two components, the innate and the adaptive immunity, the one part that's your innate immunity is primarily dominant when we're awake. So that's defending us against like inhaled, ingested, absorbed pathogens. That's useful because we're in contact with many pathogens during our waking time. But when we're asleep, our immune system switches roles so that this adaptive immunity becomes predominant. And that part of your immune system, for example, creates antibodies that you need to defend you against these viruses or pathogens that you're exposed to. And another component is that your immune system then also trawls your body looking for damaged and mutated cells and destroys them. So by having sufficient sleep opportunity, and specifically probably the deeper stages of sleep, we afford our immune system the time that it needs to get this incredibly important background work done so that we are healthy and that we can handle the stresses that are and the physical stresses really that are associated with our just being human.
So there's almost two elements to that recovery. One is the making sure your immunity and your immune system is working well versus also the physical recovery of exercise.
Yes, absolutely. Because when we sleep, we hopefully get into some nice deep sleep. This is non-REM stage 3 sleep. It's also known as slow wave sleep. And most of us, we should do about 20% of our night should be in the slow wave sleep. And during slow wave sleep, we produce growth hormone, for example. And that's really important in helping our muscles adapt to the training stress that they've had. And so we take deep sleep really seriously when it comes to athletes, because it is an incredibly important part of making sure that their muscles can strengthen and adapt to the training that they've done.
Do athletes need more sleep, and how do you know what type of sleep and how long you need to sleep for?
Yeah, they absolutely do require more sleep. So the guidelines at present for adults sort of are that you need 7 to 9 hours of sleep. For some people, 6 is necessary, and other 10 or 11 is necessary for those. So the
10 or 11,
yeah, really? Wow. And so when it comes to athletes, they do need more than the general population, absolutely. So when I see an athlete who is sleeping 7 hours, I'm deeply suspicious. I don't believe that is going to be enough if you've got a high training load to sustain that training without you running the risk of either burning out, going into overtraining, or just not performing as you need to. So you can, I'm not going to put a number on it. I can't say athletes need X amount of hours more, because it will also depend on the stage of training. You know, perhaps when you're in your base training, your sleep need is not quite as high. Once your training ramps up, then up goes your sleep need. And so it is actually quite cyclical as well. And then obviously you need to make sure that you are well slept ahead of events. But if we go back to the athlete sleep need, and how do you know how much they need? So, I mean, the key is to look for a couple of indicators if you're at your sleep sweet spot. One of them would be that on your off days, if you're extending your sleep, so we call that catch-up sleep, by more than an hour and a half, then that means that what you've been doing in the days before has been insufficient. So that's one.
So in other words, that's waking up when you wake up rather than having an alarm waking up.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. And normally that happens for most people on weekends, but for athletes it's a little different, because very often you've got training and competition on weekends. So it's just literally on the days where you're a little bit more free. The other thing to look for is falling asleep too quickly, funnily enough. So we should take 5 to 20 minutes or so to fall asleep. And if you're crashing when your head hits the pillow within sort of a minute or two, that's a sure sign that you're in some form of sleep debt, and that probably your duration isn't sufficient as well. So those are two of the key markers that we look for to understand if a person's at their sleep sweet spot. The other thing, of course, is how you feel in the daytime. And if you feel refreshed, rejuvenated, you should literally, within 30 minutes of waking up, you should be good to go. You should have loads of energy. You shouldn't be dreading training sessions, absolutely. And you shouldn't be procrastinating during the day and sort of thinking, well, I'm going to do the easy tasks because I'm taking it easy on myself. Those are all signs that probably you aren't recovering as you should at nighttime.
Mm. Rach talked quite a lot about naps, Dale. And then listening to you now, to saying that the important part for recovery is the deep sleep. Where does a nap come in terms of the sleep cycle?
Oh, I'm interested to hear this one.
Okay, so naps are slightly contentious, but let's think about it like this. So for the average person, we really don't usually advocate for napping. We prefer people to do one consolidated nocturnal sleep. We're designed to sleep at night, essentially, and ideally our nighttime sleep should be good enough. There are cases where we grant people a nap license, and athletes fall into that category simply because very often their sleep need is so long. It may often be 10, 11, even 12 hours in a 24-hour period. It just physically may not be possible to get that all at nighttime, especially when you have to wake up early for training sessions. So in those cases, then we definitely would advocate for napping for athletes. It just relieves a little bit of that sleep pressure and fatigue that accumulates more quickly for them during the daytime. And while it doesn't necessarily have the same benefits that we would get from our nocturnal sleep, it can do a lot for mood and a lot for sort of mental recovery. And those are important factors to consider. So from that perspective, we don't mind some napping in athletes. Just the duration and the timing is actually really important, though. If the napping is too long or too late in the day, then you inadvertently delay your bedtime, which then constricts or restricts your nighttime sleep. And then you're in this vicious cycle where you keep needing to nap to try to top up your overall sleep duration. So it can be quite a useful strategy. How long, probably in the realm of sort of 30 to sort of 60 minutes is good. Sometimes athletes will need a little bit more, closer to 90 minutes, but it really just depends on where they are in their training cycle.
So the critical thing, as you say, is to make sure that nighttime sleep still remains quite robust. And you're not basically, as you say, that's an interesting component, because I think always the temptation is you sleep in the afternoon and then suddenly you're going to bed at 11 o'clock at night because you can't fall asleep in time, which I guess is what you don't want to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So the first rule is your nighttime sleep has to be in tip-top shape, and only then are you permitted to put a nap in if you still need extra sleep for recovery.
Yeah, yeah. Just when you talk about the measuring of sleep, and you've given the signs of when somebody's not sleeping well or needs more sleep. You talked about the fact that you can, on your rest days, you can sleep through until you wake up in the morning. It gives you an idea of where your sleep is. Must you measure your sleep? There's always that thing about sleeping before midnight and after midnight is about the time. In other words, if I go to sleep at 11 o'clock at night and I'm an athlete and I sleep till 8, I'm still getting X amount of hours in terms of that sleep, but I'm having it later and waking up later. Does it make a difference there?
So there definitely were some thoughts some time ago that people were sort of preferring some sleep to happen before midnight, and at the very least, because they would say, well, you get better quality sleep before midnight than afterwards. And I'll explain why that's a myth now. But actually, the most important thing is to sleep in sync with your own body clock. So when I speak about your body clock, I'm speaking about our body's circadian rhythms. Those are the 24-hour rhythms. And each of us has a slightly different rhythm. But essentially, what your body clock does is it determines your preferred timing of sleep. So I'm sure you've heard of the term night owls or larks, morning people, before. So if you're a lark, then having an early bedtime, maybe 9 o'clock, for example, and being up at 5, that's ideal. Now, of course, you've got 3 hours before midnight because that's when your clock has decided that it's your best time to sleep. Whereas a night owl could never fall asleep at 9 o'clock. You would actually create a pattern of insomnia if you tried to do that. They often need to go to bed at midnight, 1, sometimes even 2 in the morning, and be left to sleep the next as late as possible the next morning. And so the first rule of thumb here is to actually sleep in sync with your own clock. That's when you get the best quality. It's not around when that magic midnight occurs. And probably the reason that myth sort of surfaced is that when you look at sleep, the first component or the first part of your sleep, the first third, is when you do most of your slow wave or your deep sleep. And so they were probably looking at that and saying, well, that seems to be happening before midnight, so it must be really important. But it would happen regardless.
Do certain kind of athletes benefit in different ways when it comes to sleep? Because obviously when you talk about sport, there's rugby players, there's breakneedling polo players, was a swimmer, endurance athletes, skilled athletes. Do they benefit in certain ways from that sleep?
Yeah, I guess we could think of it in those terms. I mean, obviously, we always think about sort of the adaptation of muscle because that's what athletes are doing. But in terms of their training, but the other thing is probably to think around skills that require sort of coordination and precision. And one of the things that happens when we sleep is that we strengthen neural pathways that we made use of during the daytime. So if you think about an athlete who is deeply reliant on a lot of coordination, for example, or very complex motor patterns, then all of these pathways in your brain that you made use of during training need to actually be they actually are reinforced at nighttime. And that means that you become more proficient at that movement. It becomes almost second nature. And so in part, when you sleep, you're actually able to help embed those pathways. So from a skilled perspective, that is super important.
Sure.
That was pretty much what Rick was saying as well, wasn't it? That when one of his techniques to go to sleep was to think through the training that he'd done during the day and to try to reinforce that. So whilst going to sleep, that's going on in his head.
Yeah, exactly. So that actually has a dual role, because on one hand, by picturing a specific movement, you're actually using some of those neural pathways, which is really helpful. But the other thing that he's inadvertently doing there is that one of the reasons we don't fall asleep easily is because we have a busy mind. Sometimes it's just ruminating on things. Sometimes it's worrying. Sometimes one of our clients uses the word, I have a grasshoppering mind. I love that. It's just jumping around all over the show. And so by doing the visualization that Rake has described, it's actually a way of focusing your mind and shutting out the fluff around the outside. And that certainly can help put you into a space where you're more likely to be able to fall asleep than if your mind is all over the place.
You were asked a little bit about the travel issue, because that's a big one in sport.
Obviously, you know, high performance athletes who are traveling all over the world to their competitions, how much does the feeling of jet lag influence them, Dale?
Yeah, jet lag's a big factor, and there's a couple of things that we can think about it. So when we travel, there's good old travel fatigue. I mean, there's just having to sit in an aeroplane with many people and travel sometimes for up to a day to get to where you're going. But when we speak about jet lag, we're really looking at what's happened when we've traveled east or west across multiple time zones, and we've disrupted our body's circadian rhythms. And so we know that the symptoms of jet lag begin to sort of manifest once we've crossed at least 3 time zones, going either east or west. And what happens is that you arrive at your new destination and you are now on your home body clock, or your body clock is on your home time, and you need to now resynchronize to something which could be 8, 10, even 12 hours out of sync. And so the symptoms of jet lag are the things that happen to us when we desynchronize our body clock. And that can be quite debilitating. It interferes with our sleep. It interferes with our physical and cognitive capacity, which obviously impacts training in the new time zone. And we need some time to recover from it. And we'll chat a little bit now about sort of strategies to do that. But also just one thing to consider is that we actually notice that in humans, when we travel west, we recover slightly more quickly than if we've traveled east. And there are a number of reasons for that. But essentially, when we're traveling west, we're having to what we call delay our body clock. And so that means make it slightly longer to match the new time zone. And that's actually easier for our bodies to do than if we've traveled east and we have to advance our clock. And what that means in practical terms is that we actually have to go to bed when it's maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it doesn't really feel like we're ready to go. So for that reason, we take an extra day or two to recover when we've traveled east v west. And the basic rule of thumb, although it's not the same for everyone, is that for every time zone crossed beyond 3 time zones, you need approximately a day to fully recover. So what does this mean practically for athletes? Ideally, then athletes would travel quite well in advance of an event so that they've had time to recover and get their training back up again before they compete. As well, not to mention obviously making sure that they're not sleep deprived going into the event. Of course, that comes down to practicality and cost, you know, sort of teams or athletes that don't have the funding would, I mean, every day that you're away, it's a hospital, it's a hotel bill, it's food in a strange place. I mean, there's all sorts of things to consider. So it's not always practical, but certainly the teams that are well financed will always make sure that they travel well in advance so that the athletes can acclimatize. So I don't know if you want to chat a little bit about the tips for athletes to resynchronize.
Yeah, but before you get into that, I'm always interested because you talked a bit about the jet lag and obviously your body's got to adapt to the certain time zones. If you talked a bit about larks and owls as well previously, is it possible, and you look at, like, for instance, if you're staying in the same country, competitions we know in certain countries start at different times. For instance, in cycling, here in South Africa, most events start early in the morning. In Europe, they start at midday, basically. Can you change being a lark or an owl? In other words, are you genetically born like that, or are you able to change that pattern? In other words, was I an owl 5 years ago, and suddenly I want to become a lark because I want to be able to train in the morning?
Okay, so a large component of your propensity to be an owl or a lark or anywhere in between, the good old neither type, is genetically driven. So we have a number of clock genes that we call them, which can have variants in them, which makes your clock slightly earlier or slightly later. So that is primarily set. But we think about this owl-lark, sort of what we call this phenotype, on a continuum from extreme night owls on one side to extreme morning types on the other. And so, yes, your genetics places you somewhere on that continuum in a ballpark area. But then through conditioning, one absolutely can shift your chronotype a little bit to be a little bit earlier or a little bit later. So we typically find with athletes through repeated early morning wakings for training sessions, high training volumes, and therefore big fatigue at the end of the day, they do often shift slightly towards the more morning-oriented part of that continuum. And then when they pay back their sleep debt and recover and stop training, they might shift back to their natural timing again. So that's one way to think about it. But
Do we know, for instance, whether larks are more successful in sport than owls purely because they're able to wake up in the morning? When I think about particularly in sport, if everybody goes to school sport, they're doing swimming before school in the morning and athletics before school, particularly when they're talented. If you are naturally predisposed to be a night owl and you're waking and you can't get up and operate early in the morning, I'd imagine that larks are more likely to be successful as sports people.
So we've looked into this, and to some extent, yes, your chronotype is absolutely one of the predictors of performance. However, I'm going to caution this really carefully. It depends on the time of day at which you would normally compete. So when we speak about cyclists and runners and Ironman triathletes, they often have very early morning events, and so often early morning training, and these all favor the lark, the early person. Without a doubt. And in fact, we've done studies which show that in South African marathons, the larks tend to outperform the owls. And we would think that that is because events are earlier, it's at their preferred time of day, and they can tolerate those early morning training sessions better, and they can actually get more out of themselves when they train in the mornings. We've looked at similar studies in the Netherlands where the marathon timing is quite a lot later, and there we don't see quite such a strong favoring towards the morning people. And we've also looked at rugby players, Super 15 rugby players, and there we don't see this massive bias towards morningness because rugby matches take place at any which time, actually very often towards the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily important that you are a lark or a morning person. The other thing to consider is like what time of day should an athlete train? And this has a lot to do with one's chronotype. So the thinking is that if you're a night owl, night owls hate exercising in the morning. I cannot emphasize that anymore. It is far better that they sleep in and that they don't go to those early morning training sessions. In fact, that's quite destructive. So rather let them train at the end of the day, regardless when they're going to perform. They'll get more out of their training sessions and they will therefore adapt more. Whereas morning types, super happy to train in the morning. They don't particularly like training in the evening. They've run out of steam and they would rather just be relaxing by that stage. So you want to train in sync with your body clock. And of course, you want to train more or less whenever your events are. So for the night owl who decided to take up marathon running, what a silly call. No, I'm kidding. that night owl needs to do the most of his training or her training at the end of the day, but they will need one or two morning sessions here or there just so that their body knows what that's like, and because that's the time of day that they will be competing.
Sure. That's fascinating, isn't it? So let's talk strategies. First of all, strategies on getting good sleep for athletes, and then maybe you can also embellish a little bit on that whole issue around jet lag. So let's talk about the average person, what the good habits, the good things they need to consider.
Okay, cool. So in terms of good sleep, everybody thinks about duration. And yes, you want to be in the ballpark. I mean, obviously, you can't get away with 5 hours of sleep and be an athlete and hope that that's going to turn out well for you, because it's not over time. Mm-hmm. So you want to be in the ballpark for duration. But far more important than duration is quality. Quality is actually very, very difficult to measure, because duration, we can all... So we know what time we went to bed and what time we woke up. It's easy. But what in the world does quality actually mean? And so quality might include duration, but it also includes things like continuity. So, you know, how disrupted is your sleep? So you definitely want to make sure that as much as possible, you're having one continuous nocturnal sleep, as we've mentioned, and that you're not having to wake up for any reason. So if you've got a pesky dog that is going to keep bugging you during the nighttime, the strategy is that that dog needs to not be anywhere near your bedroom at nighttime. I mean, obviously, there's instances where we can't control sort of what wakes us in the night, but to be as continuous is very important. The other thing to consider is the actual regularity of your sleep. And this is now gaining huge traction. So what we look for is how similar or how close are your bedtimes in any given week and your wake up times in any given week, and therefore the duration of your sleep. And the rule of thumb is that you want no more than about an hour and a half duration between your earliest and latest bedtime and earliest and latest wake up time. So this consistency or this rhythmicity is important for two reasons. Firstly, helps your body anticipate sleep better. So it knows, cool, this is what we do. We go to sleep at this time. And secondly, it helps entrain your body's circadian rhythms, funnily enough, which is a really important component of healthy sleep too. And so then the last component that we can control is also sleeping in sync with your body clock. So just picking a bedtime and a wake time that makes sense for your own body clock. There are loads of other strategies that people talk about, and I'm going to leave that for now, which are sort of the things that you do during the daytime, the hygiene related things. But I think that the things that you can really clearly control are those that I've just spoken about.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later in one of our podcasts on the line. Well, thanks very much. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, for all of us who are amateur athletes, I guess there's aspects of that which we can take in as amateur athletes that also, but obviously professional athletes, there's a much more serious component, because it does lead to good performance if you are sleeping well, essentially. Yeah. Dr. Delray, thanks very much for your time. Dr. Jill Warner, thank you much again, and we'll see you on our next podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.